Bob's World. Bob's World. Soccer. NFL. Bob's World.
Bob's World, brought to you by
American Leak Detection.
Here's Bob.
All right, before this gets too far in the rearview mirror, I wanted to offer you a brief book report on a book I have completed recently about Kurt Cobain. Now, I got to this book because the author died a year ago in August of 2024. I don't think Charles R. Cross was considered for the trifecta, but he did die at the age of 67, having written three New York Times bestsellers, guys. One on Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen.
One on Jimi Hendrix. And then one on Kurt Cobain. He is a Seattle writer and music critic, and therefore is kind of thought of, I suppose, as one of the top documenters of the Seattle music scene. And well trusted. And I fell down this rabbit hole that also includes the 60 songs that explain the 90s podcast. And Rob, the host of that, will pick a song and an artist and just do an episode. And I think it's fantastic. Well, one of the ones he did was, of course, Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. And I think, if I remember this correctly, he always brings on another music critic to as a guest, but the music critic he brought on for that one was Courtney Love. And they had like a two-hour conversation about Nirvana and about Cobain, and Courtney Love obviously is in a much different spot in her life now. But she referenced Charles R. Cross, who has written the best book ever about Kurt. And so then I thought to myself, well, that's interesting to me. I'm going to go pick up this book.
I mean, she lived it.
She lived it. And I come to find out that one of the reasons she thinks it's a great, great, great book is because some critics say that it's a collaboration between her and Cross. That the author was able to get access to all this because Courtney wanted the proper book written about him and made sure that this guy had all the materials he needed.
Even though she killed him.
Even though,
well, Lando,
she did not kill him, of course, but that's a fun conspiracy that at one point, who was that guy who even made the documentary Kurt and Courtney? The Bashir or Martin Bashir?
Was that Martin Bashir that did that, too?
Yeah, I believe so, because he did Tupac and Biggie as well, right?
Yeah.
Do I remember this right? I think so. And I think he did a Michael Jackson interview or something.
Yeah, he did.
Whatever became of that guy. Anyway, I read this book, and it's obviously fascinating. Now, you will also want to know that for whatever reason, Dave Grohl did not agree to be interviewed for this book. I don't know if Dave Grohl said to himself, you know, I've got a book coming out.
This segment's going to be about Dave Grohl.
But everybody else in Kurt's entire life seemed to want to tell stories about Kurt, and they start when he's just a wee lad, and I think like just about every musical artist, they all have some chaotic childhood or upbringing, like, very few seem to have a squared away family scene who end up being big in rock music. Is that fair?
True.
Or just a dad that loves them.
Yeah, I think so.
And they go stay with them over Christmas. Like it's just seldom a beautiful family fulfilling scene that drives somebody to write music and
pain makes art.
There you go. I think that's well said. By the way, this book is called Heavier Than Heaven. And it may be interesting to know that I think it was written like 25 years ago. So if this was the book everybody was talking about, your boy missed it.
Okay.
Until about a month ago. But I guess what I wanted to talk about a little bit in this book report, first of all, if you're interested in Nirvana at all and Kurt and just what a weird dude he was, but also a legend, but also made into a legend's legend, probably partly because he died at 27 like so many musical
geniuses
did. No
doubt. I mean, he was already at the super legend point of his career. Like, they were larger than life. Everything surrounding them was just way too big at the time. None of them wanted it. You know, it just happened. It was all right place, right time. Everything broke perfectly. And they were the face of an entire movement.
An entire movement.
Yeah, but when you exit at such a young age, you don't sully your legacy with jumping the shark, like, or selling out.
Present-day Axl Rose.
Yeah, getting fat, whatever it
right.
is.
Yeah. Doing a bunch of albums nobody cares about. Like, obviously, the downsides of being dead are that you're dead.
Right.
That's a tough one.
And that your fame probably won't matter to you in your afterlife scene. But the upside is that it puts a mysticism around you that is eternal, it feels.
Yeah, and you have this perfect time capsule of perfect
prime.
Work.
You're always in your prime, right? So a couple things in here. I certainly some people care about this and some don't, but I found a few that I wanted to tell you guys about. One, so Nevermind comes out in 1991, and you could argue influential albums in our lifetime that Nevermind is probably on the short list. And that year, I'll just read this paragraph, when Kurt filed his 1991 taxes, owing to the arcane way the music industry pays royalties so late and the huge percentage taken by managers and lawyers, his gross annual income was $29,541. He had deductions of $2,541, giving him a taxable income of $27,000 during a year he played before hundreds of thousands of fans and sold 2 million records.
And, so the money came the next year?
Well, I mean, honestly, the money was always there, but not nearly what you would have thought it was going to be. He wasn't just making $27,000, you know, till his death in 1994.
Yeah.
But it was not ever absurd amounts like you might have thought. And that struck me as what a musical god he was at the time, and thinking and then reading the accounts of, like, the apartments and the sleeping in the car. And,
well, dude, I mean, Dave watched Becoming Led Zeppelin, and
oh yeah, I've been meaning to get to that too.
Weeks before, not even weeks, the day that Jimmy Page asked Robert Plant to basically try out for the band, Robert Plant was homeless.
Yeah, he was living in his car.
He had
That's
not even
wild.
In a car. I think he was just on the streets, just kind of bouncing around. But whatever the case, Robert Plant was completely homeless. And then that year, they went super platinum and all that. And the rest is history. But these guys, man, it ain't all roses getting to that point. It's a tough, tough world.
Yeah, it's just weird from our standpoint when we're listening to things coming through the radio in real time. Like,
right.
Those of us on this show were all affected by 10 and Nevermind and these albums dropping in real time, and we're hearing them for the first time, and we're thinking, what must their life be like? And it's definitely that you're not definitely not imagining that as they're
right.
on MTV every 30 minutes, and you're just assuming it's the life of private jets and mansions and so forth.
Well, I mean, Eddie Vedder working at the gas station, making $5 an hour, sending his tape in, you know, a week before he got the gig.
Yes. There's other various things in here, and in the interest of time, I won't go too deep into them, but there was a time when bad radio, and it wasn't my half of bad radio, it was definitely Dan's, but somehow he became friends with Gibby Haynes of the Butthole Surfers.
Mm-hmm. Was Gibby connected to Kurt?
Oh, yeah. In fact, a couple things. I want to say Nirvana's first tour let's see, on October 28th, what year is this? I want to say it's 88 or so. They landed their most prestigious gig yet, opening for the Butthole Surfers at Seattle's Union Station. Kurt had idolized Gibby Haynes, lead singer of the Surfers, so the show was very important to him. Sound problems again derailed Nirvana from putting on their best performance. But the very fact that Kurt could now announce to his friends, my band opened for Gibby Haynes, was another piece of evidence to boost his self-esteem. And I'm like, wow, that's really interesting. I had no idea. And then later, as we are now near the end of his life, it was rehab in Los Angeles, and 2 days before he shot himself, he's in rehab with Joe Walsh and Gibby Haynes.
God.
Kurt checked in for what was scheduled to be a 28-day program. He was assigned room 206 in the 20-bed facility. That first night, he went through a 40-minute intake interview with a nurse, and afterward, he came down to the common room and sat next to Haynes, who had been one of his idols as a teenager. Quote, everyone was going to a Cocaine Anonymous meeting, but Kurt said he was going to stay at Exodus because he'd just gotten there, Haynes recalled. He looked sick and tired of being sick and tired. Kurt then broke out of there, drove back to Seattle, or actually flew back to Seattle. And at this point, Courtney was far, far away.
She went to Trent Reznor's studio.
In L.A.?
I believe it's in Atlanta.
Okay. Because she was across the country when
right.
when he actually died, and they went back and looked at the residence and so forth. But I had no idea, like, arguably one of the last humans he talked to was Gibby Haynes.
Wow. And Joe Walsh was there, too?
Yeah.
So that's the year he got sober?
Yes. Damn. So I guess this was an L.A. place where rock stars would go get sober?
I guess, yeah.
So just a lot of weird, like, I didn't have any idea that part of Nevermind was recorded in Madison at Butch Vig's studios.
I didn't know anything happened in Madison.
Yeah, so I guess why I'm working at Avis Rental Car and Subway, Nirvana's in there rolling through some of their songs on Nevermind right down the street, Dave.
You could have seen them.
Yeah, maybe you were the sandwich artist for, like, the engineer comes and grabs a bunch of footlongs for the studio.
I knew I should have been friends with Butch Vig. Anyway, Heavier Than Heaven is a 25-year-old book I really enjoyed, and maybe you'll like it, too.
Awesome. Awesome. All right.